Today is Tuesday, March 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the White House denies the president plans to fire the man at the helm of the Russia investigation. Facebook comes under fire from UK and US lawmakers.
People start going down the rabbit hole of clicking on blogs, websites, etc., that make them think that certain things are happening that may not be.
Also ahead, beautiful music coming out of a maximum security prison in New York. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is adding a new lawyer to his legal team in the Russia investigation. Joseph DeGenova, a former United States attorney, has publicly discussed what he believes is a brazen plot to frame Trump with a falsely created crime. It comes at a sensitive moment in special counsel Robert Mueller's probe of the Russia meddling, as Trump's attorneys weigh whether Trump should submit to an interview with the special counsel and under what terms. The White House is continuing to deny Trump is looking to fire Mueller. The news follows the Friday night firing of now former deputy director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Andrew McCabe. Attorney General Jeff Sessions fired him. McCabe, who had been with the FBI for more than 20 years, and it was just 2 days before he was about to retire. Sessions cited reports by the Justice Department Inspector General and the FBI that found McCabe had made an unauthorized disclosure to the news media and lacked candor, including under oath on multiple occasions, as reasons for the termination. In a statement late Friday, McCabe called his firing retribution, saying, "I'm being singled out and treated this way because of the role I played, the actions I took, and the events I witnessed in the aftermath of the firing of former FBI Director James Comey." Joining us now to talk more about all of it is Ron Hosko, a former FBI Assistant Director and the current president of the Law Enforcement Defense Fund. So thank you for being with us, sir. What's your initial assessment of the McCabe firing?
All FBI employees know that lack of candor, that candor issues, particularly under oath, can result in the equivalent of a death sentence, that you could be terminated. And every year, people are terminated for just that reason. It really almost eliminates you from ever testifying in court. And here we have an extraordinary case where those concerns are applied to the deputy director himself.
What about how it came about?
Before I pass any sort of judgment on whether I think he did wrong or was wronged, I want to read the report in its entirety.
All we've heard about is how, you know, this happened late on a Friday night, that the president had been talking about it for a long time. Andy McCabe comes out and says this was really about discrediting the Mueller investigation. All of this seems so unusual. And the timing of it, 26 hours before he's set to retire and turn 50, has raised some alarms as well.
This is occurring against the backdrop of presidential tweets that were directed to McCabe, commentary to McCabe and to the press about McCabe, and a comment a few months ago about whether McCabe would be, in effect, racing the clock to grab his federal pension after having done some wrong. And I think this is where it kind of gets unusual, because the idea of carving McCabe out of a bigger investigation for the purposes of punishing him when he could have been punished at any time were they inclined to. Typically, in an internal investigation of this nature, the agents who are appealing, that appeal process can last weeks or months. You have the representation of counsel. You can do an oral presentation back to the assistant director. So to me, it strikes me as quite unusual. It's almost as though this was a game of beat the clock, and the clock being McCabe's retirement date. The judgments behind the speed of the appeal and when it occurred and what other additional appeal rights he might have, that's kind of, to me, a little bit suspect. And particularly when you have a president certainly casting his vote in the public via his tweets and having a relationship with the attorney general that is significantly under pressure. You know, I look at this in a way almost as though the attorney general gets to decide McCabe's fate while a gun is pointed at his own head. So I think there are some questions that ought to be asked and ought to be answered.
Is there any legal recourse at this point for McCabe?
That's a good question. Andy's a smart guy. He's an attorney himself. I've worked with Andy. We were both assistant directors at the same time. I saw Andy as a very hardworking, smart public servant, patriot who has sacrificed much family time, like a lot of folks do, for the nation. And I may change my opinion when I see the facts and say, well, you can't do that. You're fired. Too bad. But in the meantime, it's troubling how this end state came. I don't know what the future is. I would expect, Andy, being a lawyer, having some means, I would certainly expect, if nothing else, he would contemplate a lawsuit against the government to try to get those retirement benefits back that were denied him by some 26 hours. That part is concerning, particularly in light of the broader contributions to our nation's safety that I think ought to be considered. I don't know that they were.
The Russia investigation in general, basically calling this thing a witch hunt. He has also hired another attorney that has brought up a conspiracy theory that the president was framed by the Justice Department and the FBI, and that this thereby leaves this whole investigation illegitimate, basically. What do you say to all of this?
I think there are some very determined efforts and voices that are pointed toward delegitimizing Bob Mueller's appointment and Bob Mueller's work. You're seeing the perhaps proof of the value of Mueller's appointment by guilty pleas and indictments that have already been brought at a fairly good rate of speed, in my estimation. There are complexities to certainly any investigation that, like this one, that involves connections overseas, whether it is just across the pond or whether it is to the Ukraine, Russia, others. And because of the complexities, you know, that's an investigation that's going to take some time to unfold. The investigation is the investigation, as long as it's not just free-ranging and that Mueller is making progress with it, which appears as though he is. I think there are still substantial questions that need to be answered, and I hope that Mueller answers them. I think that this is serious business, that the notion of any sort of collusion is very, very troubling. We've already seen determined Russian efforts to influence the election, and so the natural extension is to me, certainly look at the DNC hack, understand where the DNC information went, to whom, where it went after that, and if Mueller can answer those questions and exclude any connection that they went back to the Trump campaign or that there was some sort of illicit collaboration or cooperation, I'm confident that Mueller is looking in that direction, among others.
All right. That's Ron Hosko, former assistant director, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the current president of the Law Enforcement Defense Fund. Facebook had its worst trading day in the U.S. in 2012 as details emerge about how a data mining company working for the Trump campaign improperly obtained and kept data on millions or tens of millions of users during the 2016 election. A former employee of Cambridge Analytica said Monday that the group identified voters who might be swayed and injected content that may or may not be true. Chris Wiley, a Cambridge co-founder who left in 2014, said the firm used such techniques to learn about individuals and create an information cocoon to change their perceptions.
This data was used to create profiling algorithms that would allow us to explore mental vulnerabilities of people and then map out ways to inject information into different streams or channels of content online so that people started to see things all over the place that may or may not have been true. This is a company that really took fake news to the next level by powering it with algorithms.
Late Friday, Facebook said it would ban Cambridge Analytica, saying the company improperly obtained the information from about 50 million Americans alone who downloaded the purported research app described as a personality test. Facebook first learned of the breach more than 2 years ago, but hadn't disclosed it until now. UK lawmakers have already called on Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg to testify before a parliamentary committee. And joining us now to talk about all of it is Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. What can you tell us about all this?
Well, obviously, this is a challenging situation for Facebook, having allowed their app, better for worse, utilized by Cambridge Analytica to obtain what appears to be the user data of up to 50 million users. The way this worked, apparently, was that Cambridge Analytica, which was a company formed by, in part, Steve Bannon, Robert Mercer, who's a big fundraiser for President Trump, and some folks that were working at a elections firm in order to essentially mine data and try to develop what they call psychographic profiles of users. They then contracted with a small company that was run by a researcher named Alexander Kogan, a Russian-American researcher, who then told Facebook he was doing some research for academic purposes, which of course he wasn't, and developed an app that would poll people, essentially, that voluntarily. But then it would be able to scrape data from not just the people it polled, but from their friends also. Mm-hmm. And so this application, which polled hundreds of thousands of people, was able to scrape data apparently of millions of people, and they were able to provide tremendous amounts of information, you know, in sort of in violation of their agreement with Facebook to this analytics firm, which then turned around and was able to develop these profiles.
It appears possibly that Facebook knew about this a long time ago before this came to light to the public. And some analysts say they're still playing down the scope of this. Do you agree?
It's hard to know. It appears that Facebook news reports are to be believed. And again, all we're going on right now are what The Guardian and The New York Times have reported.
Right.
But based on that reporting, I think what it appears to be the situation is that Facebook also did seek to reach out to Cambridge Analytica and say, look, you have data that's not appropriate in your hands, and you have data that you're not authorized to have, and you may be using it for unauthorized purposes, so you need to destroy it. And that happened what looks like potentially 2 years ago. So that itself presents, I think, a significant challenge, because at this point, 2 years later, and to the extent that Facebook was aware of this and didn't disclose that, that could be a challenge for them.
The UK's calling for a big inquiry, too, over this. So they're in some hot water right now.
You have U.S. politicians, including Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, calling for an investigation. You've got a variety of MPs from Britain calling for an investigation. And I believe the Attorney General of Massachusetts has said that they're going to be investigating the actions of Facebook here. So, and Cambridge Analytica, obviously, also. So this is a challenging situation. Over the last few days, Facebook has been out there talking about it. They've been responding. The responses themselves have generated some response back from the community. And so there's a little bit of a challenge going on with Facebook Online also. Led their chief security officer, Alex Stamos, to delete some of his tweets. They're trying to get their arms around how they want to respond to this and how to deal with this, frankly, internally, and how to respond to the concern that they've known about this for a while, if that in fact is true, and what to say about that and how to explain that.
Has Facebook just grown to be to the point where it's just so big that it can only deal with keeping track of so much?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think, look, Facebook makes its business by, you know, servicing its users, giving them a quality product they like to use. You know, people are very much into Facebook, and they enjoy using it just like they enjoy using Twitter, and just like people enjoy buying things on Amazon. And these are big companies that have tremendous amounts of data about their users. But they use that data to provide a service to their users that their users want. It's not like anybody has gone into this unwitting, knowing that mm-hmm. Facebook knows a lot about them, or that Google knows a lot about them, or Amazon, or, you know, or Twitter for that matter. And so people go into this thing knowingly, and in fact, they actually prefer when these platforms push them information that they want to see, right? That's part of their desire. And you know, you and I both regularly click on things that say allow notifications or mm-hmm. allow this person access this app to access a certain amount of data on my phone. And so, you know, people can't really go into this and say we were unwitting or, boy, we really need to regulate these companies. I think what we can say is these companies need to think about the data they have and use it in a way that's not going to make their users upset, because, you know, hey, you have enough of these incidents and your users are going to get upset and they're going to leave you for alternate platforms, because at the end of the day, you may love the service, but if you don't like what's happening with your data, you have choices and lots of choices in this modern era. And so companies shouldn't assume that just because they've been successful and they've got stickiness now, you know, that they'll have stickiness in the future. MySpace, you know, is the classic example of that. MySpace was the social networking spot to be on back in the day, and Facebook blew them out of the water in a heartbeat. That is true for companies like Google and Twitter and Facebook and Amazon and the like. And I think they realize that, and they realize they have to be good stewards of people's information. I think, you know, these companies are trying to do that, but obviously as they grow quickly, there are challenges there.
All right. That's Jamil Jaffer, founder of the National Security Institute. And here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Saudi crown prince will visit the White House on Tuesday. The Taliban is skeptical of the Afghan government's peace offer. President Trump seeks the death penalty for drug traffickers to curb U.S. opioid abuse. And Canada announces a peacekeeping mission in Mali. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the hunt for the serial bomber who's been leaving deadly explosives in packages on Austin doorsteps took a new and more sinister turn on Monday when investigators said the fourth and latest blast was triggered along a street by a nearly invisible tripwire. Police and federal agents said this, it suggests a higher level of sophistication. Two people have now been killed and four wounded in bombings over a span of less than 3 weeks. And there's been a lot of talk about it on social media. VOA's Doug Bernard tells us more.
It's fascinating to watch in real time how this hashtag Austin bombing is floating through social media. And it's also very interesting and a good reminder about how information isn't always correct. I just was looking at one post, two people killed today, you know, in this fourth bombing. Two people weren't killed. Two people were injured. They were not killed. What we do know is that there have been four bombings so far. We have no idea who's doing them. We have no idea what the motive or any of that is. But very quickly, you are seeing on social media a lot of people talking about, well, gosh, this doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention, and maybe it's because the bombings are targeting people of color, i.e. African-Americans or Latinos, mostly African-Americans, although that is not quite true with the fourth bombing, the tripwire bombing. A lot of people angry about what they perceive as the larger media not covering the story, and they are putting this spin on it that says they're not covering it because these are bombings that are targeting African Americans, you know, and if these were bombings that were, say, targeting white Christians, we would be calling it terrorism. Nobody's calling it terrorism right now. So you're seeing a lot of heated anger about not just the bombing, but what the media response has been so far.
All right, Doug, thank you. And you can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, alongside Spider-Man, the Hulk, Captain America, Black Widow, and the other superheroes of the Marvel Universe is Ms. Marvel, a young, shape-shifting crusader for today's diverse American society. Aronde Butiano has more on the first Muslim superhero to have her own dedicated series.
She may be a newbie in the world of Marvel superheroes, but since she burst onto the comic book scene in February of 2014, Ms. Marvel has become a cultural phenomenon.
I love this comic because it is diverse and it shows, a side of America that I think comics don't always show.
She's only not dealing with the school side of things, like the culture clashes, like her parents are trying to be traditional, and I guess that's a bit cliche, but she's really struggling with it because she wants to maintain her Muslim identity.
That's right. Ms. Marvel, a Pakistani-American teenager named Kamala Khan from Jersey City, is Muslim. So is her creator, G. Willow Wilson.
She faces a lot of the same challenges that any teenager faces about family, school, peer pressure, what she wants to do with her life. So the real goal was to make the book feel real. How can any reader from any background see themselves in this Muslim girl in the Marvel Universe?
Comic store owner and Orthodox Jew Menachem Lukens welcomed Ms. Marvel fans to meet the author at his Huntington, New York store. He says he relates to Kamala.
There's a scene where Kamala goes to the mosque and she's talking about the responsibility you have towards people, sort of vaguely implying she might be a superhero, but she doesn't want to tell the imam that she's... And I have those hypothetical conversations with rabbis in my head. Could I be allowed on the Sabbath to break Sabbath laws, to use my superpower? Like, these are things that I thought of. So Ms. Marvel connected with me immensely.
The point of a superhero is to be a symbol for the culture at that time.
Kamala Khan's hometown of Jersey City, New Jersey, is one of the world's most diverse cities. Her fictional school is based on the real McNair Academic High School there.
All the places that Kamala has been, we get to see that. It's pretty awesome, you know, that they base a superhero off our school. Yeah, and I think that the comic book represents the diversity that we have in our school.
For many people, this character is their only exposure to Jersey City, only exposure to Islam, to depictions of Muslim people that defies the traditional Hollywood idea of, you know, Islamophobic representation. So it's just interesting to see, especially in this political climate, how this character has really become such a symbol.
In 2015, the first Ms. Marvel graphic novel won the Hugo Award, the highest prize in fantasy and science fiction literature, for the best graphic story. Ariadna Budianto, VOA News, Huntington, New York.
Well, the maximum security prison known as Sing Sing lies some 80 kilometers north of New York City, and it's not the sort of place that you would expect to find a flourishing music community, but reporter Jeff London went there to observe a workshop Carnegie Hall runs for the inmates, and some of their songs were performed last week on Carnegie Hall's main stage.
Sing Sing Correctional Facility opened in 1828, and there is still a kind of Victorian severity to it, from the rusty iron bars to the dimly lit corridors, where prisoners in drab green jumpsuits are led by guards who now communicate by walkie-talkie. There are 1,600 inmates at Sing Sing, and Deputy Superintendent for Program Services, Leslie Mallon, says the staff is always thinking about the day they'll get released.
Because most of the inmates are going to go home and be your neighbor and be my neighbor at some point. So we assess them and we take a look at what are some of the things that they need before they go. We have an associate's degree program, a bachelor's degree program, a master's degree program.
And a music program. Twice a month, artists from New York City come to Sing Sing and spend a day giving the 30 inmates enrolled in the Musical Connections program formal training. Before it started 9 years ago, Sing Sing had a music room. But Rob, the Department of Corrections, asks that we don't use any last names or say what brought these men to prison, says there were often fights about who could use the room.
Where we had fragmented fighting groups, now all these guys are part of this weird cohesive thing where we have to play together and we're all of a sudden we're doing an instant duet, me and somebody who hates me.
If black lives matter, who do they matter to?
Rob has been on parole for the last year and a half after spending 7 years in Sing Sing. He played just 2 open mics before he went in. Joe had even less experience.
I didn't know what an A-flat was. I've heard these terms. I couldn't have explained them to you. I didn't know what they sounded like. I didn't know what they meant. Or what does it mean to be? What does it mean that A is flat? Don't know.
But he's been in the program for 4 years, studying music theory and harmony, and even got to work with opera star Joyce DiDonato.
She definitely opened my eyes to something that I didn't even know I had within myself. After I met Joyce and I started to actually listen to classical music, because before that, I didn't listen to any classical music.
Now he collects opera scores and is writing one of his own.
I will not forget.
Musical Connections program is run by Carnegie Hall's Manuel Bogoro, who oversees similar programs in shelters and community centers.
People have come together, they play together, they negotiate artistic decisions, they sort out problems, but all with enormous affection for music.
And those are all skills that inmates can use on the outside. Danny was released from Sing Sing 3.5 years ago after 7 years in the prison system. He learned the violin and started writing music.
After being released from prison, I was able to take that same drive and the same dedication that it takes to learn a musical instrument and to compose into other areas of my life.
But I'm the way things are is not the way that it has to be. No, I'm holding on to love, holding off despair, and I'm holding out hope. I'm holding on to love, holding off despair, and I'm holding out hope.
That's a song by Kenyatta, who's been in Sing Sing for the past 23 years. One of the teaching artists, Sarah Elizabeth Charles, says she's seen both personal and musical growth in the prisoners over the years.
I just think the sky's the limit for so many of the men in this workshop. Many of them are working on a level of a professional musician, and that's really huge, and yeah, sky's the limit.
For the members of the workshop who have been released from Sing Sing, Carnegie Hall hosts a monthly gathering, says Rob.
It showed me that everybody was struggling, trying to find a job, trying to stay employed, trying to find time to practice in this hectic life. I knew I wasn't alone in any of those things.
When you feel you're getting tired.
When you feel and like other members of the Musical Connections program who are out of prison, Rob's been getting his life together. He's working as a bike messenger, he's gotten married, and he plays various musical gigs around town. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition, and that does it for today's show. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Cornelius Wilson. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Defense Secretary James Mattis said he sees no change in Russia's military capability in light of Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent speech, in which he said Russia has developed new strategic weapons systems capable of attacking the United States. As Secretary of Defense, Mattis said his role is to make strategic assessments, and he determined that there was no change to the Russian military capability in Putin's remarks. The systems the Russian president talked about are still years away, the secretary said, adding that he doesn't see them changing the military balance. They do not impact any need on our side for a change in our deterrent posture, he confirmed. The recent cancellation of scheduled strategic stability talks shows a Russia that's not even acting in its own best interests, said Secretary Mattis. Turning to Syria, Mattis noted that Russia signed up with the United Nations Security Council for a ceasefire in Homs, Aleppo, and East Ghouta. Their partner, the Assad regime, proceeds to bomb, at best indiscriminately, at worst targeting hospitals, he said. I don't know which it is. Either they're incompetent or they're committing illegal acts, or both. Secretary Mattis told reporters he is aware of reports of chlorine gas use and of the bombings taking place in Syria. It's almost like a sickening replay of what we've seen before, in Aleppo, for example, and before that in Homs, he said. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley worked with the U.N. Security Council to reach a ceasefire in Syria, and Russia's partner immediately commenced violating it, Mattis said. We're working through diplomatic means, continuing to work, he stressed. We don't give up.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA.
You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.